Hey, this is Pastor Jay Lee, and you're listening to the Daily Sabbath Podcast. Okay, so today our topic is parenting, which is everyone's favorite topic. You know, a lot of times when I pick topics for the podcast, I pick them based on maybe questions that people have submitted or things that I know that you listeners really want to hear about. But to be honest, I picked this topic because I need to hear it. You know, I am a parent of two. I have two young daughters, one who's a newborn. And man, I need every piece of parenting advice that I can get. And so my guest today is Lindsay Wagstaff. And she is a mom and a therapist and a Christian. She's currently in the middle of a PhD program in clinical psychology with an emphasis on working with children. And she also has a blog on Instagram called Grace for Kids, where she just shares information and resources on what she calls grace-based parenting or respectful parenting. And so I wanted to ask her to be a guest on the podcast because I was really intrigued by this concept of respectful parenting. And, you know, what is it exactly? Grace-based parenting. I mean, it sounds like something important, but it's not something that I had ever really heard about in the context of parenting. And so that's why I wanted to invite Lindsay to be on the podcast and share a little bit more about it. And so, Lindsay, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast today.
And thank you so much for having me, Jay. I'm so excited to get to share a little bit more about this.
You know, yeah, it's kind of a unique topic. I mean, before I came across your blog on Instagram, I had really never heard of respectful parenting or grace-based parenting. And so I guess maybe just to start, like, why did you start Grace for Kids?
That's a great question. I honestly started, some people might think that I'm quirky because I like to read books and articles from psychologists and experts in child development in my downtime. So I started the Instagram because I found myself posting on my personal Instagram things that I was learning, and I wanted to make sure that the people who were following me didn't feel bombarded with parenting information and that it was just a separate account specifically devoted to this interest and passion of mine. I love sharing what I'm learning with others. I find this topic, like you said, as a parent myself, I also have a young child. It's been personally life-altering for me. And so I want to share that with as many people as I can.
And so, you know, I mean, maybe just to jump right into it, like, what is respectful parenting? I mean, I guess in some sense, I would think all of us want to be respectful, but like, what does it mean, respectful parenting or grace-based parenting? Are those terms interchangeable?
I use them interchangeably, yes. So respectful parenting is a relatively recent term, and it's one of several terms that's used to describe parenting styles that are grounded in connection and trust, as opposed to coercion and control. There are some other overlapping terms that you might hear. Those would include one of the more familiar terms is authoritative parenting, which is distinct from authoritarian parenting. Lots of people are now talking about conscious parenting or mindful parenting, peaceful parenting, grace-based parenting, and gentle parenting. So there's a lot of overlap between these terms. I prefer to use respectful parenting as my default because I think the phrase carries this connotation of honor that's very central to the approach. But other people who parent very similarly might label themselves differently. That said, I don't identify with the label positive parenting because I tend to find that it's more behaviorist, using rewards to incentivize desired behavior. And I don't personally use or recommend reliance on rewards or praise in my practice as a therapist.
Okay, so there's sort of like a constellation of different terms or different styles of parenting and that are somewhat related, that have some overlap, but also have some nuanced differences from one another. And so the one that you particularly kind of prescribe to is this respectful parenting, grace-based parenting. Maybe you could go into that a little bit more, like what might be a distinctive of specifically respectful parenting? Like, so you just gave an example right there of a distinction from positive parenting, but would you be able to like maybe give any other examples of some distinctives of respectful parenting over and against maybe some of the other ones that you've named?
Yeah, think it would probably be helpful to go macro first and kind of talk about the backdrop and how this began to appeal to me and how I see it in standing in contrast with some of the more popular self-help parenting books that are on the market today. I've been intrigued by parenting since I was a teenager, but my interest really blossomed into a passion when I was preparing to become a mother a few years before my son was born. I love my parents deeply, and I actually didn't question much about how they raised me until adulthood. I assumed that I would spank my future children because all the Christians that I knew were vocal about spanking. Mm-hmm. And if they weren't talking about spanking, they were talking about other behavioral methods of controlling their kids' behavior. So I often heard church leaders say to kids, your sole job is to obey. That's just the baseline of how conversations were. They were very oriented around power and control. And for parents, the instruction was on how to confront sin in your children. And then several years ago, again, before my son was born, I met a woman at my church who told me that she parented without using punishment of any kind. She said she was practicing respectful parenting, and I was simultaneously fascinated and completely skeptical. But because I was fascinated, I read the book she recommended, and I ended up becoming deeply convinced that respectful parenting was not only biblically defensible and theologically sound, but that it conveyed a more accurate and beautiful vision of God's unconditional love. So yeah, as you mentioned in the beginning, I'm a therapist. I'm in this PhD program in clinical psychology. And as I continue to delve deeper into the world of child development, I just saw this growing chasm between popular Christian parenting and these beautiful discoveries from neuroscience and neurobiology that can help inform how we understand our children and their behavior. And because I believe all truth is God's truth, and I think God's design and the way he created children and their brains is good, and there are relatively few voices who are explicitly talking about respectful parenting as Christians, that is how I became interested in starting Grace for Kids in the beginning.
So maybe if I could just kind of break in there for a second. Yeah. So it sounds like then, well, one, you met someone who actually was doing it and had done it. And I'm assuming you saw that there was good fruit. Like, I'm pretty sure you wouldn't have listened to her if her kids were, you know, running amok and, you know, swinging from the chandeliers. But so you met a lady who was a believer who you respected, who was practicing this respectful parenting. But then it also sounds like the other factor is that, you know, just as you have been doing research and getting more educated on kind of like the latest science of parenting styles and outcomes, that it's kind of a confluence of your Christian belief, but also with kind of the data, the objective data that you kind of have run into as a researcher and as a scientist. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. You know, I think that even though popular Christian parenting books talk about Christian parenting from a biblical perspective, there is a clear influence of psychology in those books. It's not necessarily labeled as such, but I would identify the psychological theories in these popular Christian parenting books as behaviorism. They are talking about basic principles from behaviorism and adding spiritual language. In operant conditioning, which people use in animal training, rewards are introduced to reinforce desirable behavior, and punishments are introduced to decrease behavior. Mm-hmm. Mainstream Christian parenting utilizes this basic framework and then mixes in the concept of sin. So the result is this deep incongruence between the good news of the gospel for adults, where grace is offered freely, and the good news for children, where, you know, every grumpy tone or refusal to say thank you is an opportunity for the child to be corrected and to learn about their selfishness. Mm-hmm. I think there's also a great amount of pressure placed on parents to save their children's souls from death through the rod, through constant correction. There's this idea in a way that we save our children even though we hold to grace through through faith, not by works, through our discipline, and we're shaping them into these moral beings. But I have a lot of questions about that. I've gained more questions over the years, even about the way that that moral training is formulated in mainstream Christian parenting. Mm. I think, you know, as a culture, we give lip service to this idea, again, that salvation is by grace, but then we're turning around and teaching our children that they're only acceptable in our presence when they're behaving well by a standard that we set. And it might not even be that the standard is developmentally appropriate. It is so socially acceptable to send your children to a room when they talk back, when they make a mistake, or when they don't comply instantly. Mm-hmm. I think it's even more socially acceptable to bribe children and to goad children into good behavior through praise and through rewards. We're taught to wield this human connection that we have as parents as a power tool. We're taught that being warm with a child who's just disobeyed or lashed out is going to reinforce the undesirable behavior. And I think when I think about Romans 2:4 in the CEB, it says, "Don't you realize that God's kindness is supposed to lead you to change your heart and life?" And Ephesians 2:8, you know, it says that we're saved by grace, not by works.
Yeah. Okay. So let me break in there for a second, because there's so much stuff there, so much good stuff there. So let me just kind of repeat back to you some of the things that I'm hearing you saying. So one of the things that I heard you say kind of towards the beginning there, which I think is a new insight, or because, you know, I was saying that your kind of interest in respectful parenting comes from not only your Christian faith, but also kind of the confluence of that with the scientific data and, you know, sort of the parenting models and methods, right, through research. But I think what I heard you saying there is that Christian parents who take sort of more of a traditional, more authoritarian approach, they unwittingly, without realizing it, are also applying kind of like research-based parenting models that I guess the current research would say are not as effective. And so that was the first thing I heard you say that I thought was like very insightful, that, you know, because I would imagine a lot of Christian parents parent in the way that they do because they believe like, oh, this is the Christian way of parenting. This is the way that my Christian parents taught me, or this is the way that my church taught me. But you're saying, maybe in some ways it is, because that is kind of the models that Christians have set up for us. But what they don't realize is that a lot of that might be actually having adapted these, I don't know what the right term would be, having adapted these, I don't know if secular parenting models mm-hmm. is the right word, but would you describe it in that way?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's so much overlap when I read secular psychology textbooks that have a behaviorist slant mm-hmm. and when I read Christian parenting books that are more, as you say, traditional. Mm-hmm. We call it behavior management plans in psychology, and we just call it disciplining our children in church. Mm-hmm. But both of these tactics are conveying a conditional acceptance where we have kids earning warmth and affection through compliance. And that's where I think we have a cultural blind spot, and we're parenting by default in ways that are actually antithetical to the gospel of grace that God offers us.
Yeah.
So I have most problems with operant conditioning, using that on children. I think that's fundamentally dehumanizing. Mm-hmm. And so I feel passionately about helping Christians see that there is a radically human way that we can relate with our kids without using coercion and control, just like God, as our Heavenly Father, does not motivate us using coercion or control.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the other piece that I was hearing that I definitely wanted to bring out to make sure that, you know, people are catching this, that even though we believe that we're parenting in a Christian way, that the way that we're parenting our kids is, yeah, like you said, almost antithetical to the gospel message, right? Where it's very, very much performance-based and very much conditional. And basically, you're only accepted if you can perform up to a certain level that we expect. And if you don't, you're literally, quite literally, sent away a lot of times, which is almost a picture of kind of the law. Okay, so yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are very... these are things that I've never heard before, mostly because I've never really had any in-depth conversations about parenting, you know, in a church setting or with a pastor or anything like that. And so that's probably one of the reasons why this is a novel conversation for me. But so let me kind of, I'm going to just kind of play the part of, you know, the person who's listening to this, the Christian, who is somewhat maybe like skeptical about what they're hearing. Yeah. Here's what I think the main question will be. They're probably thinking, well, you know, but we do know that discipline is important, right? Like the Bible tells us that we should discipline our children, you know, and they might point to the Bible verse about, you know, spare the rod, destroy the child, things like that, right? And so, you know, I think the question that a lot of people might be thinking as they listen to this is, yeah, so are you prescribing that we don't discipline in parenting? Because it seems like discipline, at least, is a biblical concept, and even says that God disciplines, you know, those who he loves. And so I don't know, how would you answer that question for people who are wondering if basically respectful parenting is about not disciplining our kids?
That's such a great question, Jay, and I'm so glad you asked, because yes, absolutely. Warmth without limits and boundaries is permissiveness. Permissiveness is a form of neglect, and permissiveness is deeply harmful, deeply detrimental to children's development. I do tend to address authoritarian parenting more than permissive parenting, because authoritarian parenting books are popular in the church, and I can't think of well-known authors or speakers who are advocating for letting your kid do whatever they want. But permissive parenting and authoritarian parenting both fail to help children flourish, to feel secure or seen. So I think, yes, as you said, we need to address discipline directly. And I think we need to ask ourselves, what is discipline? Discipline comes from the root word disciple, and it encompasses teaching, guiding, instruction. So then the question for me becomes, how do children learn? What is most effective? And I want to speak more to that later when I talk about the science of safety. I think a lot of this is coming down to the questions that we're asking, and translation is so important in helping us disentangle our expectations. The word obey doesn't actually appear in the original text of the Bible. The King James Version translators chose the word hearken, and that was later changed to obey in Ephesians 6:1. So I believe a more accurate translation of Ephesians 6:1 would read, "Children, listen to, thoughtfully consider, and respond to your parents in the Lord, for this is right." So here, it's not about instant compliance. To me, the verse sounds like it's describing a mutually respectful relationship built on trust. And instead of asking, how can I get my child to obey? I've started asking, how can I help my child learn how to have self-control? How can I help my child develop wisdom? Instead of asking, how can I get my child to obey? I'm asking, how can I help my child learn how to authentically choose what is good and reject what is evil? Not to please me, not to avoid feeling personal pain through punishment, but because they love the creator of all that is good and they love their neighbor as themselves. Ephesians tells wives to submit to their husbands in the Lord, but if a church is teaching husbands how to force their wives to submit to them, that's an abusive interpretation of the text, right? Submission has to be chosen. So I think it's key to note that the directive to children to obey is given to the children. Parents are not told to force their children into compliance. The directive to fathers is given, fathers, do not exasperate your children. So while we are told to discipline our children, if we're understanding that from a framework of teaching, guiding, and instructing, then we can move away from equating discipline on a one-to-one level with punishment.
Okay. Yeah. So I like what you're saying there. So you're saying at the core of what discipline is discipleship, which is essentially training or teaching.
Yes.
In this case, our kids. And so your thesis is, or your theory or thesis is basically, what is the best way for our kids to learn to become the people who God created them to be? And at least based on the research that, you know, you've done and your own experience, that respectful parenting and grace-based parenting is much more effective than behaviorist or authoritarian type parenting.
Yes, I do believe that. You know, I do want to address the elephant in the room as well, because there will undoubtedly be listeners who are thinking like I did, you know, but punishment does work. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very important thing to talk about. So let's imagine two different scenarios in a grocery store with two different parents. One parent, okay. Let's call him Robert. Let's say he has a two-year-old boy who is born with a sensitive temperament. We know all kids come from the womb with different temperaments. Mm-hmm. And let's say his parents would say that he has a strong will. Robert was a sensitive child when he was growing up too. He cried a lot. He felt upset more easily than his siblings. His parents had a more authoritarian style of parenting, and they would smack him every time he cried about something that they felt was inappropriate. If he whined, he was smacked. If he cried, he was told big boys don't cry. If he fell and skinned his knee, he was told he's okay. So Robert grew up without emotional validation, and now he's a dad. He's in the store with a two-year-old. His two-year-old has some big feelings. And at home, Robert treats his son in the same way that his parents treated him. He spanks, he yells, he uses timeouts. He's a little softer sometimes. You know, he gives hugs, he says, I love you, but he still feels embarrassed about his son's perceived stubbornness. And his primary game plan as a parent is to show him how to submit to authority. Now, if you are just an observer in the store and you see Robert's son's lower lip start to quiver, and you see Robert place a firm hand on his shoulder and he gives him a look, and then his child pulls it together. There's no more quivering lip. There's just a calm two-year-old in the checkout lane. The clerk tells the boy, he's such a good boy. If you're looking from the outside, that punishment that was experienced at home can, for some children, appear to be effective in creating well-behaved children. It can. I was extremely well-behaved as a child. I was punished as a child. I was shamed as a child. Now let's imagine that there's another dad in the store. Let's call him Eric.
Can we call him Jay? Because I feel like Jay's going to be the better example here.
Okay, let's call him Jay. All right. Jay was raised by authoritarian parents too, but he's learned about respectful parenting. He's trying to break the cycle of shame in his family. Jay has a two-year-old son as well. And on this day, Jay's son is completely flooded. He's overwhelmed. The store is overstimulating. It's sending his brain into threat detection mode. He's hungry. It's almost nap time. Suddenly, you know, he's flinging his body onto the floor. He's pounding the floor with his fist. Jay has set a boundary, and he said he couldn't take the bouncy ball home. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they put those toys right at eye level with the kids.
I know why.
Yeah. I know. But Jay set the boundary. No more toys. They have enough toys. And now there's this meltdown. So Jay gets down on the floor at eye level, and he calmly says, I hear you. You're really, really disappointed. Jay's calm. He's not taking this personally. He's aware that people are watching him, and he's consciously choosing not to think about their judgment. He's focusing all of his energy on his boy. He also knows that it's not socially acceptable to be having a meltdown in public. And so out of consideration for others, he decides to carry his son outside for more privacy. And he gets low eye level again. Again, with body language conveying gentleness and also confident leadership. He says, you're having a really hard time. I'm going to help you by carrying you outside so you can get some fresh air. And he scoops the boy up, takes him outside. His son continues to scream at the top of his lungs for another 3 minutes. And then the screams subside into sniffles. His boy is able to verbalize what he's feeling. He says, so, so sad, so hungry. Dada. Jay opens his arms. He offers a hug. His son gladly accepts. He pulls out a snack from his bag. After the snack, they go back into the store. If you're an observer in the store and your measure of parenting success is how many meltdowns a child has, then a respectful parenting approach might look like a flop, especially if you don't get to see the co-regulation that was happening outside and how, you know, the boundary was still held, but there was no threat that was used. There was no reward or bribe that was used to get the child to comply. Robert's son might have looked quiet and well-behaved because he was afraid of being shamed or smacked again in private. Robert's son swallowed his feelings without a single word, just a look, because he's already learned that his big feelings are not containable by his father. I would say that the ability for a two-year-old to swallow their feelings like that, I'd call that a trauma response. I'd say that they're learning not how to self-regulate, but how to repress and hide their feelings. Extraordinarily well-behaved children can grow up to be adults who are struggling with anxiety and people-pleasing, legalism, lack of authenticity, communication issues, anger. And these are all things that I have struggled with myself. And that's because I never learned how to process my feelings in a healthy way. Anger and sadness were not allowed. Robert might look like an effective parent in public, and Eric or Jay might look like a pushover. But there's beauty in what Jay was doing. Jay had appropriate developmental expectations for his kid. He assumed at baseline that his kid was doing the best that he could, that his kid needed support, not shame. He didn't judge his kid for having a meltdown. He didn't lecture. And that took self-control, right? The fruit of the spirit on his end as he's talking himself through it. He was going internally, my son's logical brain is offline right now. He needs support. He needs co-regulation. Focusing on his own breathing and intentionally working to make sure he's putting his child's emotional health above how he's being perceived by strangers, not compromising on the boundary. The toy stays in the store, but it's just a fundamentally different approach of framing the behavior itself.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, and that was a super helpful illustration, I think, to kind of see, like, in a real world scenario, what this might look like. And I think the thing that I was kind of picking up there is that one of the things that I'm seeing is that with the more kind of traditional model of parenting, that maybe it's faster, it's more expedient sometimes, right? Like, it's like you can get sort of the response that you want from your child maybe more rapidly. Whereas kind of the second scenario with that very excellent parent, Jay, that, yeah, like you said, that it requires sort of that fruit of the spirit and that patience because, from he wasn't able to just kind of quell that tantrum on the spot, you know, with a look, and also kind of that outside pressure, which I feel like is something that a lot of parents could probably identify with, where, you know, if you're in the middle of the store, you don't want other people looking at you like you're like this horrible parent, you know, like who can't control their kid. Like, why don't you just control your kid? Right. You know? And so, I could see that it requires a lot more patience, and there's sort of expedience versus maybe a more of a long range view of teaching and disciplining your child. But it seemed like what you were saying there is that the long term fruit in the life of your child between those two views is that, you know, maybe even though in the short term you might get the behaviors you want from your kid with a traditional approach, that the long term fruit of that type of parenting actually might be counter to what you would hope, counter to healthy attitudes in your child.
Yes, I think that was just beautifully, beautifully stated. And absolutely, respectful parenting relies on an underlying belief that parenting is slow, that child development is slow, that you don't have immediate results. And there's a lot of trust embedded in it. There's trust that, you know, God made our brains to develop at a certain pace, that over time, through modeling, through consistent, you know, there is structure, there are boundaries and limits, through consistent interactions with caregivers that are safe, where you can experience, I've used this word, co-regulation, where your parent is modeling the calm, self-control. They're not dysregulated. They're not entering into the child's storm. They're being the center of peace while their child is experiencing an emotional storm. A child is learning not just from the words that come out of our mouth, but from the way that we interact with the world, how we solve problems. And so I think what we may not realize when we're doing traditional parenting is we're modeling a form of problem solving that relies on force. It relies on control. It's not collaborative. And I think what we all want our kids to grow up to be able to interact with other people in difficult relational situations without needing to resort to a blunt power move, where they can ask questions and find compromise and negotiate and lead with confidence. Mm-hmm. I think in that example that I gave with the meltdown, I was also touching on intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation, mm-hmm. because the extrinsic motivation, as you said, it is very immediate. We share as people a desire to avoid pain. So if you're experiencing consistently a painful response from your parents when they are unhappy with you, the desire to avoid that may be very strong mm-hmm. for some kids.
Yeah.
But, and I think this is the crux of the issue in so many ways. If we zoom out, and I'm going to go big picture again, I think when we look at the church right now as a whole, we are seeing an epidemic of abuse and hypocrisy in so many ways. Like when I heard about Rabbi Zacharias, for example, and I heard about how he had abused women for so many years, completely unchecked, I thought, this is what it looks like in a very extreme way when someone is motivated to do what is right only when they will face consequences, only when they've been found out. And if you have a level of power paired with privilege that allows you to have a significant level of immunity against facing personally painful punishment resulting from your actions, and your primary motivator is to avoid experiencing painful personal consequences, mm-hmm. then you're able to say one thing in public and do a completely different thing in private, mm. where you can get away with it. It's why I think a lot of times when parents punish their children for saying something untrue, it creates this cycle where the child is then motivated to lie again to escape being punished again, and there becomes this divide. It doesn't encourage the child to be honest and vulnerable about their mistakes and later their sins. Instead, there's this desire to hide, to present a good face in public, and cover up in shame mm-hmm. the sin or the mistakes. And I just can't help but think about that when we're teaching our kids not to harm others, because if they do, we're going to harm them. Mm-hmm. We're not effectively teaching them a skill, and we're not teaching them how to love what is good, how to choose what's good because of their inner sense of morality. It's completely dependent on who's watching.
Yeah. And I think I've seen a lot on the Grace for Kids blog where, you know, you've kind of, you know, made posts where kind of pointing out sort of somewhat of the hypocrisy of some of the kind of traditional parenting methods, right? Like the one that you just brought up, right? Where, okay, you're in trouble for hitting this other kid, therefore I am going to hit you. Where it's kind of like, okay, that is a very confusing message, yeah. right? One is bad and one is good, right? And so, you know, what is the long-term fruit of that kind of hypocrisy? Or maybe hypocrisy is too strong of a word, but contradiction in right. logic. And so, you know, I have seen that you shared posts like that on the blog in the past quite often. And so those ones always kind of hit me in the heart, like, that's true. You know, I like to style myself to be a very logical person. And so mm-hmm. when I see that and see like, yeah, you know, that's not very logical, you know, If I want my child to grow up to be a logical person too, the parenting has to be congruent with the lesson. And right. you know, you're pointing out here that sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
Okay, so then what do you think about consequences? I don't know if this is just kind of semantics here and you would kind of see them as the same thing. But okay, so we're saying that we don't really want to rely just on punishment and behavior modification through punishment. But what about consequences? I think that's a word that a lot of parents might use. Like, oh yeah, I give my children consequences. So in the respectful parenting, grace-based parenting model, like, are there consequences?
That is such a fantastic question. Yes. Yes, consequences are actually an important part of respectful parenting. And I want to distinguish between natural consequences and logical consequences and punishment. So we'll start with punishment. Because sometimes people say punishment and consequences and they are using them synonymously. I don't use them synonymously. Punishment, as I understand it, is inflicting a consequence with the intent to generate an aversive experience so that the child is de-incentivized to repeat the same behavior in the future. Mm-hmm. So there's an emphasis in punishment on causing emotional or physical pain to de-incentivize future behavior. A logical consequence would be directly connected to the behavior itself. So an illogical consequence might be, let's say you have a teenager and they're supposed to be home at a certain time, and they go over to a friend's house and they don't tell you. When you find out, an illogical consequence might be they're not permitted to play video games for the mm-hmm. next 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. It's not connected to the behavior itself. It's just inflicting something that the parent thinks would be painful to them. So the motivation to not repeat the behavior in the future would be connected to not desiring removal of privileges. Mm-hmm. A logical consequence would be directly connected. So if you have a small child and they are flinging an object, or let's say flinging sand, and the sand is too close to another child, it's getting in their eyes, a logical consequence of that behavior when they've been asked to stop and they have not stopped would be to remove the child from the sand, or to remove something that they are wielding in a way that's unsafe. If they are likely to break something, removing that from them, then even though the child might have a strong reaction and they still desire to be engaging in that behavior, the consequence is that they are not permitted to do so any mm-hmm. longer. A natural consequence is something that you don't even need to enforce, because the way that God has designed the world itself embeds natural consequences into our actions. If you are holding a glass cup and you drop it intentionally to see it as you're experimenting with gravity, mm-hmm. as children often do, it shatters, it's broken, and sometimes children learn quite quickly, although I was never brave enough to experiment with glass, as some parents do, yeah. They would learn that that is not safe. Mm-hmm. A natural consequence of being angry at your parent and lashing out at them is this internal sense of disconnection, maybe heaviness. There's a shame children often experience when they are not living in alignment with their values. And I can see that even with very small children, even as young as 2 years old. And so when a child is already feeling bad, we don't necessarily need to impose a punishment to make them feel even worse. We can acknowledge that in many cases, the natural consequence of their behavior is already being experienced, as it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good to any child mm-hmm. When they are not when they are not doing well, they're not feeling well about it.
Mm-hmm. So in that case, like if it's a case where there's sort of a natural consequence, like, you know, your child was, you know, playing with the glass cup, maybe it's something that they really love, and then you told them not to, but they did, they dropped it and it's broken, and now they're sad because this thing that they really like is destroyed. So they're already feeling the consequences of it. So would you say in that case, as a parent, like, you don't necessarily need to punish them on top of it because they already are feeling the consequence, you know, naturally? So then would you say, what is the role then of the parent? Is the role just to sort of help articulate the consequence? Or like, what would you say is the role of the parent there? It's just,
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I've never seen a child attached to a glass object. I'm sure it exists.
It's a poor illustration.
but yes, even if they weren't attached to it and it broke, I think there would be that sense of sadness mm-hmm. that they broke something. Maybe they broke something that was very dear to them. Maybe it was a favorite toy. And the loss that comes from that teaches them the consequences of their actions without any verbal instruction in that case. And that doesn't mean that gentle parenting or respectful parenting doesn't involve correction or verbal instruction. I think it's just a matter of discerning what is needed in the moment. Sometimes we think that the correction has to happen every time and in the moment. And when a child is physically dysregulated, their ability to take in that information and to learn is severely inhibited. And so it's actually more productive for both the parent and the child to come back and think about how could we have done that differently in a collaborative, helping way with the intent to support when the child is regulated again.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that was super helpful that, you know, you can practice respectful parenting and there are still consequences. You know, that it's just that you want them to be, you don't want the motivating factor to be, I'm trying to inflict as much pain, either physical or emotional, on my kid so he won't do it again. But it's right. really bringing out a logical consequence or letting them experience the natural consequence of their actions yeah. and learn from that.
And often I think I hear people with legitimate skepticism thinking about in a child's early years, well, what about when they're not logical, you know? Mm-hmm. What about slapping an infant on the hand or giving a spanking to a one-year-old when they do something unsafe? And people will reason it makes sense because they can't understand if you explain to them why the thing isn't safe and you really don't want them to run in the street or do something that could be quite dangerous. In situations like that, I think the onus is on us as parents, as responsible caregivers, to be aware of the physical environmental limits that need to be in place to protect our children, to do what we can to make sure that a child's not in a situation where they can be running in the street. But if our goal is to decrease dangerous behavior, let's talk about running in the street, as that's often a concern for little kids. We can think of skill building as an alternative to inflicting pain, because if the child knows the rules of street safety, and if we're practicing with them, if we have a little song as we go across the street, or if we role play, you know, on a quiet cul-de-sac and we're going across and looking both ways, all of these things are helping prepare a child in advance. You can rehearse situations before going into a store to prepare a child for the things they would see and experience there and how it would be helpful for them to behave, holding your hand. All of these things can help kids build the skills that they need that will set them up for success in the future.
Mm. Now, earlier in the interview, you mentioned something called the science of safety, and I actually have no clue what that is or what that means. It sounds important, science and safety. So would you mind explaining, like, what is the science of safety and how does that connect to this?
Yeah, thank you so much for coming back to that. So the science of safety, it's a term I became familiar with when I was learning about what's called the polyvagal theory, which was established by Dr. Stephen Porges and been written about in a book that I recommend widely to the parents I work with and anyone who's looking for a solid parenting book from a scientific perspective, called Beyond Behaviors by Dr. Mona Delahook. So Dr. Porges talks about the polyvagal theory in a technical book by the same name. I'm not going to get too deeply into the science of it here, but I do want to explain what's taking place in our children's bodies and brains when we see this behavior that can really be quite activating for us. So we have the ventral vagal system, sympathetic nervous system, and the dorsal vagal system. I'm going to refer to these as the red pathway, the green pathway, and the blue pathway.
Okay.
We can make guesses about which state our child is in by looking at their body language. If the child's eyes are alert and bright, if they're smiling and neutral, if they're able to express their feelings, if they look relaxed and they're changing their movement to respond to the environment, they're laughing or their tone is changing appropriately. These are all great signs that their ventral vagal system, the green pathway, is in charge and online. When our kids have their fingers spread, they have arched backs, they look tense, they're biting, hicking, kicking, they're jumping, maybe they're clumsy, they're bumping into things, they're falling over, they're moving fast, moving impulsively, their eye contact might be direct and very intense, or their eyes might be squinted and closed. They could be have their eyes darting around the room. They might be giving a fake smile, clenching their jaw. They could have their mouth open, You'd be seeing crying, you could be seeing yelling, sarcasm. And this one, a lot of people don't realize, is a sign of fight or flight. In kids, laughing in an out of control way or smiling while they're deliberately doing something wrong. These are all signs that the sympathetic nervous system is now dominating their bodies. This is what Dr. Delahook calls the red pathway. This is fight or flight. And then finally, we can see signs that the dorsal vagal system is in charge. The blue pathway shutting down when the child's eyes are glassy, when they're looking down. They seem tired, they're disinterested, their mouth is turned down, they're slumped. They're not curious and exploring. They're frozen or they're moving slowly. Their voice is cold or soft or sad or too quiet. God designed human connection to be this biological imperative. So when we receive pain inflicted by our caregivers or when we receive unpredictable connection, the impact of that can be traumatic for our autonomic nervous systems. And on the flip side, when we are offering our children reliable connection, we're offering them chances to co-regulate with us, to bring their nervous systems into regulation with ours. This is what you see in infancy when a mother is holding her child as the child is crying and the mother is calm and the baby lies its head on the mother's chest and suddenly the cries begin to subside. The child is kind of catching the mom's calm, co-regulation, and you can co-regulate up or down. So when we are activated ourselves, maybe we are in the red pathway, we're feeling fight or flight, and I feel this too, and even knowing everything that I know here. If I am especially exhausted and I slip back into thinking in a more behavioral way, I'm thinking that my child is intentionally doing this to aggravate me, and I also might be showing some of those fight or flight responses. And I need to bring my own body into regulation before I can help bring my child into a state of regulation, going back to that green pathway again.
I see. So, okay, let's go back to like the red pathway, which is sort of the fight or flight. One of the things I think that you were saying is that that's why, you know, you might be trying to like reason with your child or try to talk to them about it, but they're not in a mode that they can receive that or process that.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. They biologically cannot receive it. And so many lectures are wasted when a child is in that pathway. And I think the interpretation that we're often taught to perceive, the lens that we're perceiving that behavior through, is that the child is just rebellious, that we're seeing the impact of their sinful nature. And while respectful parenting does not mean that you have to take sin out of your worldview, it's also important to recognize that It's too simple to reduce it to just rebellion when their body is in a physical autonomic state where they cannot, their cognitive functioning is actually inhibited. They cannot process in the way that they can when their system is regulated. Mm-hmm. So again, this just raises new questions that we can be asking ourselves. How am I working to provide emotional stability? You know, am I present with my child? Am I giving them a relational cues of safety through my body language, through my eyes, through my tone? Is my volume appropriate? Is there warmth and care in my voice? Is my face expressing safety and engagement? Because my child, even as an infant, is able to perceive safety and engagement from my facial expressions. What about timing? Like, am I approaching and is my pacing with the child, taking their immediate needs into consideration? How can I help my child come back to a state of safety so that they can be able to reason with me rather than assuming that they're only being willful and rebellious and just forging ahead with correction in the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually my wife, she's pretty good with this, where, you know, she's pretty good at recognizing when, you know, our oldest daughter is kind of, you know, in that red pathway. And, you know, maybe they're in kind of a situation where there's a little bit of a battle of the wills going on. Yeah. But, you know, yeah, she's pretty good at recognizing that. And, you know, like sometimes, like, I'll see her be like, do you need a hug? Like, do you want a hug right now? And things like that, right? Where it, maybe kind of what you're describing there, where like physical, mindful of sort of the physical response. Whereas I think my mentality is, I'm not going to give you a hug right now. You know, like just, it's not my instinct, you know, it's not what I grew up with. And so, you know, I think I would probably tend to, you know, fall off into the mistake of too much lecturing or processing while they're in a state where maybe they can't really hear it or receive it. So yeah, I can, I hear that. And I think that's something that I can definitely work on.
And I want to say that it takes so much humility to own, especially out loud on a podcast, the ways in which we feel that we're, you know, we have room to improve, and we're not always taking our child's their needs into consideration. I also just want to normalize and say that I also don't always feel like offering a hug in a moment where my child is having a meltdown. And sometimes a child doesn't want a hug. It depends on your child.
Yeah.
But it's taken work, and sometimes I truly still will need to talk myself through it in my mind and remember consciously this is the red pathway, you know. Relational safety is needed here. So it doesn't have to be I think it's important for me to communicate that there is no such thing as a perfect parent. Respectful parenting is not perfect parenting, and our children are able to extend grace to us as well.
So when they're in the red pathway, they need relational safety. I'm going to kind of, that's a nice, I think, nice way to package it as a take home for me. And so maybe as kind of the last question for our interview, just to kind of, make it more practical as we're kind of starting to already. But so for you yourself as a parent, what do you find to be the hardest to be kind of to remain faithful with or consistent in terms of respectful parenting? Like, what are the ways that you see yourself like kind of being pulled into sort of the traditional ways of parenting sometimes?
Yeah, such a good question. So I think my answer to that question would, it shifts depending on the season that my child and I are in. There was a period of time where I was struggling to project confidence in my leadership. And that was in turn making it difficult for my son to move through his feelings instead of getting stuck in those feelings, because he could sense that I felt uncomfortable. Right now, I think I'm confident in my leadership, but I've been finding myself struggling more to refrain from judging my child when he's doing something that I might think that he should be beyond that developmentally. Especially if the behavior seems like it stopped a while ago and now it's coming back up again out of the blue. No behavior is out of the blue. All behavior is communication. But I found myself around sleep in particular really struggling when I'm feeling exhausted, when my child does not want to go to sleep. It's so much harder for me to maintain perspective. And I can share a story just from a couple weeks ago when I messed up, because I actually think it was a really beautiful story. It made me cry. In general, I think, you know, I've talked about co-regulation. I've talked about the importance of our own calm, confident leadership and presence with our children. Sometimes we're not that, and I was annoyed. I was frustrated with my son in the morning. We'd had a rough night, got up at 5 a.m. I'd gone to bed late doing homework, and my son woke up at 5 a.m. I'd only slept a few hours, and he asked for something in the morning. I snapped at him. I don't even remember exactly what I said, but there was some anger in my tone. And I ended up walking away, kind of collecting myself, had a moment of prayer with God. And I came back to my son to apologize. And I just said, you know, I'm so sorry. I spoke to you in a way that you didn't deserve to be treated like that, and that was on me. It wasn't your fault. My son said, "I forgive you." And then I wanted to explore a little further, and I said, I wonder what you were thinking and feeling when I spoke to you in that tone. And he said, I was thinking that you was feeling frustrated because you was a person. And persons feel frustrated sometimes. And when he said that, tears sprang to my eyes because I can't remember ever using that language with him. Mm-hmm. But it was what I needed to hear in the moment, that as much as we give grace to our children, there's also grace available for us. And we will also fail. We will be frustrated. And yet, this is part of the human condition. And to acknowledge that there is grace for us as well. And that is so powerful, because parenting is hard. Mm. And it's hard for all of us to maintain perspective. Yeah. So I don't want to close this interview without a note of hope there as well.
Yeah, it is true though. Yeah, I mean, parenting can be pretty rough, but I like what you said there, that grace for our kids and also grace for ourselves. Well, Lindsay, thank you so much for just taking time to share just all of these experiences that you've had and all of the knowledge that you've gained just through, you know, the latest research. And so again, this is Lindsay Wagstaff, and the name of her Instagram account is Grace for Kids. If you guys want to follow her, and just she's always sharing lots of information and resources on grace-based parenting. And so I encourage you guys to do that. But thank you so much, Lindsay.
Thank you, Jay. It was a pleasure.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please consider leaving us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Or you can buy Pastor Jay a cup of coffee. For more Daily Sabbath content, please follow us on Instagram @DailySabbath.